From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll learn what's going to happen to the large rotating powwow exhibit at the Milwaukee Public Museum after it moves locations. Then, Lake Effect producer X-Grid Nunez experiences the Wisconsin State Fair for the very first time.
I don't know, it makes me feel even more at home now. I've lived here for almost a year now. In 1 month, it'll be a year. It was kind of like a big reverse homecoming.
Plus, we'll head to Sun Prairie to learn about Odyssey Sangria, a canned sangria company founded by Milwaukee mixologists.
It's pretty awesome. Just the idea of like being able to use modern techniques and make these cool, fresh, you know, products. I never would have thought 7-8 years ago that this is where we'd be.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. One of Milwaukee Public Museum's best-known exhibits is A Tribute to Survival, which opened in the fall of 1993. The centerpiece of this exhibit is a giant turntable that rotates 37 life-size figures that recreate a powwow. With the museum scheduled to move to a new site in 2027, many questioned what would happen to this exhibit, especially the people who helped create it. When Carol and Diane Amor discovered that the Tribute to Survival exhibit did not make it into plans to move to the new museum location, they started an effort to work with the museum to make sure the exhibit could still have a future. Carol and Diane join me to share more about their plans for the exhibit moving forward. Carol begins by sharing their initial reaction to learning about the museum's plan to move.
I was very saddened, probably horrified, because we had said initially that this was an exhibit, a forever exhibit, that was being built to pay tribute to the tribes of Wisconsin and to the Native people of Wisconsin. And it still has so much to teach, and so many of those models are still here with us. And so, you know, why should that tribute stop? It's still very important, and we still have so many things to learn from it. So that's pretty much how I felt.
How about for you, Diane?
My first reaction was a question: is the exhibit going to move with the museum? And then as we learned more, when we found that it was not going to move, they started asking questions about what should happen to the exhibit itself, to the figures. And then I started to worry about, like, well, where are they going to go? Are they going to put them in storage, or are they going to break them up, or what was going to happen? So mine were basic questions. And then we started a dialogue with the museum.
So before we get into that dialogue with the museum about the future plans for the Tribute to Survival exhibit, I want to go into how this exhibit was made and curated by the whole community and what makes it unique. So typically museums have historians, anthropologists putting their exhibits together, but how was Tribute to Survival unique in how it was made?
Well, there are a lot of ways that it was unique, but probably one of the biggest was that from the get-go, once we started working on the exhibit, the museum, and I say we because at that time I was an employee of the museum, but we reached out to the Native community in Milwaukee with the idea of inviting as much participation as possible in terms of how things were said and how the exhibits looked and who should be the models and how we should go about reaching out. So at that time, that was pretty unusual because that was back in the late 80s. The exhibit had really been inspired by Indian Summer in Milwaukee. And I think that's kind of what got museum people talking about it first and looking for grants. And they got a very big grant to do the exhibit. So immediately started reaching out. And that was very unique.
So from the get-go, a whole collaborative process with hundreds of tribal members across Wisconsin. And for you, Diane, you were involved in the beginning as well. Do you recall what that first meeting or the first initial meetings were like with the Milwaukee Public Museum about 35 years ago?
I do. One of the people who came was Nancy Lurie, who is an anthropologist from the museum. And she had a relationship with some community members already because she taught classes at the university and was involved with Native community throughout the years. So when she first came, I have to say that we were kind of worried, like, why are we going to help a museum? You know?
Yeah, speculation, like, right, like trepidation.
Right,
yeah.
Because like as you said, anthropologists and historians set things up from their point of view. And so in this case, they came and asked for us to be at the table right away and that we would have a voice in how it would proceed. So in choosing the models, for instance, we decided to try to choose people who look different, not look like an Indian looks, and also that there be representation from the different tribes in Wisconsin.
And these were real people that were used for the models, which I think is so cool. I did not know that before this. I've gone to the museum all these years, and I think that attention to detail is so great and unique. And there's also some other things that were priorities for the group making a tribute to survival. So can you share some of the other behind-the-scenes production that went into this that, you know, the day-to-day visitor might not think of and know?
I think of very important story or interesting story is the first time we had what then was called a general council at the museum. And there were several planned, and anyone from the Native community in the state was invited to come and have a say, have a voice in how we were proceeding. And the plan had been that the figures were going to be behind glass on that turntable, that it was going to be totally glass enclosed. Well, right away you think that's like museums. Everything is put behind glass. And then immediately that makes it look like from the past. You know, it makes it look like it's not going forward or there, you know, it's not alive and well here right now. Outfits from the museum's collection were going to be used, and that was one of the reasons that it was going to be behind glass. So anyway, we had the first general council meeting, and there was an opportunity for people to speak. And one of the first people from the Native community that stood up to speak said, "Why are you going to put us behind glass? You said you want to do an exhibit that shows that we're still here and that our culture is alive and thriving and has survived all of these government efforts to make us assimilate. So you want to put us behind glass?" And then person after person, you know, said that. And the conservators, of course, expressed great concern, saying it couldn't be out in the air because you have to protect the outfits and so forth. Well, at that point, which I just think is a real exciting moment in the story, the head of exhibits and design stood up and said, "Well, I have an idea for this. We won't use the outfits from the collection. We'll have all the outfits made by Native people in the state." So then it doesn't have to be behind glass. And there was, you know, a lot of discussion about that. And then that's what happened. Oh, and then the other thing he said was, "And Carol Ann will gather all the outfits." So, which turned out to be great,
yeah,
because I got to travel all over the state and meet people from all the tribes. It was, what an opportunity, you know, what an honor.
As you mentioned, it was an open call to action to invite everyone in to have input. And one major group that plays a factor in this project and beyond is the American Indian Advisory Council in Milwaukee. So, Diane, can you speak to what their goal was during the time in the late 80s when they were involved in this process as well?
We decided to form a group because many things were happening in Milwaukee, like construction and different things, and we were never at the table. We were never invited. And in fact, our population is so small, we're always statistically insignificant. So we're small, and so lots of times people don't even recognize that we're here. And one of our goals was to be more visible in the community. So therefore, when they came, we thought this was an opportune time, a win-win situation for us. But then again, that concern about, you know, museums. So after a discussion, we decided that we would endorse that and therefore it could go forward. And so a lot of, like I said, the figures, the models were chosen by people from this area. And people who lived in this area.
That's amazing. And remind me, Carol, you said this took about 5 years to put this together, right?
Yes.
So for the both of you, so you were working for the museum at the time.
Correct.
And Diane, you were involved as a member of the American Indian Advisory Council and as a resident here in Milwaukee. So over the course of the 5 years, what stands out to you? Like, what do you think went well? What were some bumps in the road? Do you feel like overall it was a satisfactory process?
Well, Carol was much more involved actually than I was, but from the beginning I thought it was because we were able to choose who is going to help write the script with Carol. People would volunteer, people who had a really good background of our own history. In general, I think it was a very good process. They involved us, you know, like we got to go shopping at powwows and buy part of the outfits. My own mother made many pairs of moccasins that are there now, so now I go look and I can pick them out. So it's, to me, it was a fulfilling experience. And seeing that come alive or be a different kind of exhibit. I think a lot of our people in our community, when they go there and see the exhibit, feel, oh, there we are, here we are. So in that way, it's really good.
So as you both have been hitting upon, the importance of a tribute to survival and its legacy, its roots, but also its longevity is still needed today, especially for the educational value for people both in the Milwaukee area and beyond. So with the plans for the museum closing this location and moving to a new one and not taking this exhibit intact with it, what are the plans to make sure that a tribute to survival is not simply moved? What's happening now? What are you working on today?
Well, after Diane and I talked with Katie Sanders at the museum, and a shout out to her, she really has been cooperative and supportive. And once she kind of understood some of the things we were looking at doing, has been more than helpful. We've worked with the museum, and they've signed an agreement with us, with our tribute documentary group, so that we can produce a documentary about the making of tribute. And we're hard at work on that already. We're starting, you know, to fundraise so that we can do this. And what's terrific is that from that beginning and that signing off of the museum in December, they've now created a working group at the museum to help us. We've also talked about, after we finish the documentary, that we'll do like a virtual tour so that kids in schools or, you know, anyone can continue to tour that exhibit. But then finally, when it's time for the exhibit to move, that for those figures that don't go someplace else, and maybe you could talk about that a little bit, Diane, that they will share with us the rest of the exhibit so that we can find a new home for it. That'll be the next step. But the idea, again, would be that those stories could continue to be told, and it could even become beyond tribute. So we would add in stories from all the tribes about all the things that have been done in the last 35 years and will be done in the next 100. So pretty exciting, the possibilities. But maybe you want to talk a little bit about, Diane, the figures, how that's going to work.
Yeah. Some of the figures are of people who have walked on. And some of those families don't want their relative to be there anymore. And some people are going to actually take their own figures if they can, if they let them. But like, for instance, one person I know, the female veteran in the exhibit, she's asked that her figure goes to the Veteran Historical Society Museum, and they've accepted that offer. There's a couple of the figures that the museum wants to use and repurpose within their collections. So different things will happen with them, but as Carol said, we wanted to keep using them to tell stories, to show progress within our communities.
Yeah, so much more to build on, as you're saying. So with the start of this exhibit being a collaboration, and now with this new phase of the exhibit also being collaborative, despite the fact that it's ending at the museum as we know it now, what are you looking forward to for its future?
There's a couple things. One of the things is that this group that we talk about, the Tribute Documentary Group, there's so many people who have signed on to be part of it in different ways. Some people are really involved in, like, you know, fundraising or decision making. That's one of the things. The other thing is it's a way to carry on our story, to keep telling our story that's not in a museum. So people are just excited that our voice, the Native voice, will continue somehow.
Keying off of that, I think that fact, to see how people are coming together And also you had asked about, you know, our titles, and that we're really trying to do this in an indigenous way as well. You know, we have different groups because some are focusing more on fundraising and some are focusing on, you know, other things. But that, you know, it's consensus. We all have a voice and we all work together. And it's also very exciting to bring it into, you know, life today and looking forward. Mm-hmm. So that it's not just being, you know, held at a certain moment in time. And then to look at all those questions about, you know, what is the role of museums, or what should the role of museums be? And that question of who gets to tell the story? And to a certain extent, lesser extent probably, you know, what is, should be, or could be the role of allies? And how can this be a teaching tool? You know, and how can it be something not just for today, not just for the past, but, you know, for years and years to come, you know, looking out to the seventh generation.
Well, Carol and Diane, I want to thank you both so much for joining me today and sharing the great, exciting plans that Tribute to Survival will have. And I look forward to more updates and more conversations in the future as you continue to work on this.
Miigwech, thank you.
Miigwech.
Carol A. Moore was a script writer for A Tribute to Survival and is the administrative assistant for the Tribute Documentary Group. Diane A. Moore is a member of the Prairie Band Potawatomi Tribe and a member of the Tribute Documentary Group as well. You can find out more information about their project at WUWM.com. There is an election today in Wisconsin. There are partisan primaries for Wisconsin Assembly and Senate and two constitutional amendments on the ballot. WUWM has candidate profiles and interactive maps to help you learn about what will be on your ballot. We've also broken down what the constitutional amendments mean. You can find all of that at wuwm.com/voter guide. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll bring you some of the key results from the election. In about 20 minutes, we'll learn about a canned cocktail created by Milwaukee mixologists. But first, we'll bring you the sights and sounds from the Wisconsin State Fair and one Lake Effect producer's first experience taking it all in. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The Wisconsin State Fair is a time-honored tradition that has brought Wisconsinites together for nearly 200 years, but some are still experiencing it for the first time, including Lake Effect's Exgrit Nunez. She and Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez, a lifelong Milwaukeean, visited the fair to experience it for the very first time. In this audio postcard, you'll hear Jimmy guide Exgrit through some of his must-dos at the fair, which include cheering loudly at the pig races and going down the giant slide really, really fast.
Dude, we're here.
Do you think people from, like, outside of Milwaukee come here? Like, far away or not really?
That's a great question, because I think that the Wisconsin State Fair has the opportunity to heal the rural-urban divide.
Brings us together. This is a bipartisan issue.
This is a bipartisan issue.
Whoa, crazy, like how you know where we're going.
I like the back of my hand.
Oh, that's crazy.
It's literally like riding a bike.
Got cops and cheese curds.
10 a.m. curds is crazy. Crazy behavior.
All right, Exgrit. What does it say right in front of us?
OMG. It says Racing Pigs Arena. Hell, sorry. Heck yeah.
I told you that, you know, in the spirit of the Olympics, we're going to start the day with high-level athletics and some real competitors. Are you ready for this?
I'm so ready. This is what the Olympics is about.
You ready? It's game time.
On the dot. It's on the dot. one, two, three, four, four little piggies. They look so excited.
They've been ready. This is the first race of the day. They're raring to go.
Aww.
All right, who are you feeling?
This
is the other part of it's like betting on pigs.
Let's bet on them.
Yeah.
Let's go with Squealy Nelson.
Squealy Nelson?
Yes. Locking it in.
Locking it in? I'm going Spare Ribs.
Oh my God!
Go Squealy!
Come on!
Go Squealy!
Yeah,
baby!
Oh my God! Oh.
Squealy Nelson took last.
Oh no!
You were let down.
Yeah.
You were really let down.
But the energy is so infectious. I love this. This is what it must feel like to be at the Olympics.
I just want to go on record and say, listen, I'm one for one. Spare Ribs just tore that race up. Gabby Thomas style.
That was amazing.
I don't know what this says about us as a people. But I don't want to think that deeply about it. I just want to enjoy what I just saw.
My face hurts from smiling so much.
Right.
I never thought I would, like, cheer and suey, but here we are. Here we are. We're a new person.
Absolutely. I don't know if you're going to like this. I actually apologize in advance because I think it's really upsetting. But as, like, the Mexican representatives of the station,
yes,
had to try this out.
I'm ready to be mildly offended. Or impressed.
What do you think that CCT stands for?
That's what I'm trying to figure out. Cheese, curd tacos, no freaking way. Are you kidding me? Watch them serve it on a flour tortilla. I swear to God. I swear to God.
I'm an OG kind of guy. I don't like my tacos to be messed with. I like it very original.
Yeah.
And by that I mean brat, cheddar curds, lettuce, and Baja. I'm not sure what Baja means, but
I thought it would be ranch, but now there's like ranch listed on there, so it's not ranch.
All right, you down to split a original pack with me?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay.
They're worth it.
Oh yeah.
What did you all get? Like, what was the flavor that you got?
I got the spicy.
The spicy?
We got the pickle.
The dill pickle one.
We got
the box checker.
Okay.
He saw it on Tic Tac, and we all had to come.
So, this hard shell taco, which I don't know what this is, could be a flour tortilla. It's very hot. Cheese curds seeping out. Sauce, ambiguous sauce. Forgot there was bratwurst in here.
Your face was so concerned. I was wondering what was happening.
When you said, we are going to watch a competition, that is the last thing I expected. Maybe it should have been the first, but it was the last thing I expected. And, you know, I threw so much judgment at, like, the 10 a.m. curds just for us to shortly after eat 11 a.m. curds. So I see where people are coming from, and I think it's the true Wisconsin experience. So it was perfect.
Oh, you want the true Wisconsin experience? We've got somewhere else to go. And there will be dairy. We are in one of my favorite places at the fair, is the Wisconsin Products Pavilion, where we're gonna walk around and grab some stuff, but there is a noon show of a dairy promotion board from Wisconsin. What do you want to do while we're in here before we watch this dairy?
I want to find the craziest thing someone's selling. Because I feel like, you know, someone could be selling, I don't know, a veggie cutter or something. And you could be coming up in here today being like, you did not have a plan to buy this crazy thing, but you're walking out of it as a proud owner.
Absolutely.
So that's what I want to...
Can I just tell this guy? Hey, excuse me, your shirt is phenomenal. I just want to let you know.
Oh, thank you.
It's really good. Is that your fair shirt?
It is a Hawaiian shirt with giant beer steins on it, beer glasses, and some hops.
Amazing.
All right, so here we've got apple cider donuts. Now, that's not the most wild thing, but it is incredibly delicious. So cranberries.
Cranberries.
Absolutely. But you may not know about Wisconsin cherries.
No. It's all about the cranberry. Why is no one talking about cherries?
No one talks about cherries, right?
Oh my God, there's so much. The cherry scone, TBH.
Ooh.
I don't know.
Split a cherry scone?
Let's do it.
Okay. Can we get a cherry scone? So we need something to drink now?
Yes.
Extra, welcome to maple everything.
No.
Maple cotton candy, maple syrup, maple kettle corn, and my personal favorite, maple root beer.
No way! That's a thing!
The thing I love about having you at the fair, too, is that everything is new. And so the next thing we're doing is something I'm going to go on a limb and say you've never done before, and you've never gotten your hands this kind of dirty before.
Lean-to. I encourage everyone to come in and experience a milking demonstration today. My name is Vicki Janish. We're going to start the milking process with Passion. Passion is our red and white Holstein. And what we do is...
Yeah, do you see it going? You see the milk flowing?
That milk will go up into the
This is crazy.
Jar. And as
wow.
Passion now has been a...
I thought this was going to be some good old-fashioned milking. I was ready to see some hand action.
So far, to recap, we've done pig racing. We've gone to the products pavilion. We've done some milking, or we at least saw the milking demo. The next thing we're doing could be my favorite part of the fair. And it's the part of the fair that in a couple years, I hope that I'm a part of. I hope you're ready for it.
I'm so excited. Let's see what's next.
This is the Grand Champion Hall, and this is where you'll find the most accomplished Wisconsin Knights in the world sharing their favorite gourds, photos of cats. And one day, my goal is that I am in this hall.
Oh my God.
And I haven't figured out for what yet, but I think our challenge is as we walk through to figure out what offering we'd bring to the state that we'd find ourselves in Grand Champion
in the
Hall.
In 5 years, yes. In the next 5 years.
Are you ready for this?
I'm so ready. Let's do it. Okay, loving it already. Look at the art. The quilt.
Okay, we walked over to it.
Quilters Anonymous of Wauwatosa.
Dude, Joan is doing work. This is definitely a first place blue ribbon
best
quilt.
Best workmanship.
Incredible. Well done, Joan. So,
beautiful.
I'm never going to be in here for quilting, I know that. Okay. Listen, there's some really nice photos, but I think if I have a shot in anything...
It's photography. I love that someone just submitted a photo of their hot dog.
Yeah.
It was just, like, so good that they had to share it.
Absolutely.
Like,
and then submit it to the Hall of Champions, and then actually get it in here.
And then place in third, yeah. All right. This is what I think... I'm gonna be famous for in 5 years. Growing big veggies. Look at that onion.
Here we go, dude. Wow, this onion is almost as big as my head. Like this onion is the size of an NBA basketball.
Okay, wait, so you got first place?
Yep, the mini bells, yep. I got second here.
The chiles?
Third there.
Oh my gosh, okay, so I didn't know we were next to royalty.
Oh.
Like, obviously your garden is prolific here in
yes.
the Champions Hall. Like, how yeah. does this happen?
Well, it started with two tomato plants and two pepper plants, and then my husband told me I could grow more, and actually from seed. So I started buying seeds, and then I started growing in my dining room, and I start in February, and it goes till October 1st.
What encouraged you? Like, what encouraged you to, I'm going to submit my veggies into the fair?
I was walking through here one day, and I said, my veggies are look that good. I think I'll try this.
Yes.
Oh, here are the bonsais.
So bonsai means tree in a pot.
Okay.
So you can go get a tree, you know, and put it in a restricted pot mm-hmm. and train it to have branches going the way you want them. Yeah.
I don't know if I'm more taken by Rita and her dedication of all of her fruits and vegetables and herbs, or if I am by bonsai. Like, that was incredibly tender. I'm here for it in a way I did kind of expect, but I didn't expect at the same time.
You know what I loved most about it is, like, yes, it's my first time here, but learning about you and how at the end you were like, you know what? I'm convinced I am going to become a bonsai person now. Like, that was incredible because, you know, you've lived here your entire life in Wisconsin. So, like, how much do you think about, oh, the bonsai community, the bonsai tree grower community?
I will tell you, I think about them once a year when I'm in the Grand Champions Hall. And we are, and I'm looking at bonsai, and I'm like, this is impressive. You know what else is impressive?
What else is impressive, Jimmy?
The final thing I have to show you about the fair. All right, you ready?
I don't know what else to expect anymore. Let's go.
Extra, this one's for you.
For me? Oh my God, stop. I know where we're going.
Where are we going? What are you doing,
Expert? We're gonna go see some raptors. Oh my God.
Chirp chat at the fair, baby.
75 miles per hour. This little 2-pound rocket in a dive can reach 240 miles an hour. They are swift, they are agile, they are built for speed. And the reason for that is peregrine falcons are hunting in a much different way than our owls and our hawks, and they're hunting for different things.
I had my five things, and that was the Taylor
curated
for X-Grid experience. We're about to do something now that we've been talking about that I know you do not want to do, though. You know what it is, don't you?
I know what it is, because we've walked by it, I think, at least 5 or 6 times now, and every time we pass by it, we say, giant slide.
All right, we're looking at the giant slide, towering some 50 plus feet in the air. How you feeling, X-Grid?
A little nervous.
All right.
What a great way to end the fair. My first fair in Wisconsin. Thank you. Oh my God.
Yeah, I did.
Okay.
All right, push out whenever you're ready.
Ready? 3, 2,
2
1.
1. Oh my God!
How was that?
Thrilling.
We should pay you to do it again.
Thanks.
We did a little bit of everything today. I guess I have to ask you, you know, what did you think of the Wisconsin State Fair and what you saw?
You know what I love is, like, when we entered, you told me you knew this place like the back of your hand. I'm coming back again, and I can't wait to show other people now. Like, I know this place like the back of my hand. This was truly such an experience. Maybe I expected, like, kind of county fair kind of situation, but it exceeded those expectations. I don't know, it makes me feel even more at home now. I've lived here for almost a year now. It'll be a year in one month, it'll be a year. It was kind of like a big reverse homecoming, like Wisconsin being like, welcome to your new home. Congrats on a year. So that was really special.
When you sent me that Slack message about, hey, I've got an idea for a story, and you told me what it was, I didn't know if someone suggested you to ask me, but I'm like, I am the person for this. I am the guy, because listen, I go hard for the fair, and it is kind of what I said earlier, is like, tongue in cheek, like, it if there's anything that heals the rural-urban divide, like, it is the state fair. But, like, honestly, think about the people that we talked to and the people that we met and where they're coming in from, and Wisconsin and Milwaukee, West Allis, shout out, being an ambassador for this event. You know, it really does bring people from around the state together. And just the spirit of having a good time, eating incredibly unhealthy, but at the same time walking and chatting it up and sharing communal food at tables, which was unexpected. But yeah, it just makes me feel too, like, more connected to the state, not just Milwaukee, in ways that I would like to feel more often than not. Are you sad we didn't do the slingshot?
I'm so glad.
Dangling my feet over the sky glider chair, eating a green puff, not an eclair. I'm watching people trying hard not to stare. Won't you come with me to the Wisconsin State Fair?
That was Lake Effects Excret Nunez visiting the Wisconsin State Fair for the very first time with Lake Effects Jimmy Gutierrez, a lifelong Milwaukeean, as her tour guide. You can hear more of their experience at WUWM.com. We'll take one more break and then head to Sun Prairie to get a behind-the-scenes look at a local canned sangria company. That's next on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR.
I ate too much today, but I do not care. Woo! Won't you come with me to the Wisconsin State Fair?
This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Wisconsin is known as a beer state, both in consumption and the amount of breweries that we have. However, local businesses are starting to make an impact in the spirit and cocktail markets, especially ready-made ones. Daniel Berez is a partner at Lost Whale Craft Cocktail Bar here in Milwaukee and is a nationally recognized mixologist. He and fellow Lost Whale partner Tripper Duval, along with Tom Dufek of Plain Spoke Cocktail Company, decided to join the canned cocktail market with Odyssey Sangria. It's developed and made locally, and to find out more, I visited Daniel Berez at their canning facility out in Sun Prairie, where a fresh batch was being canned.
If anyone kind of peels the layers back of my drink history, if you will, I worked for a Spanish hospitality group for a few years, and sangria kind of just became a passion of mine. I kind of got really into making different sangria recipes while I was there, and it became something that I kind of started to get known for. People that knew me from that place would call me the sangria guy, or, you know, Captain Sangria is a really fun one from a friend. And it got to the point where I started making it for parties and stuff, and then I just kind of started realizing, you know, if I could wanted to go buy it, I just didn't have a lot to choose from. Right. So I was like, it got to a point where I wanted to make something eventually and put it out on the market. And sangria just kind of made the most sense of all the things that I had made over the last decade.
We're just going to go over basics to start. What is in a sangria? Most often it's just kind of boiled down, maybe unfairly, to it's wine and booze, but what's in it?
Yeah, usually you're finding, like, you know, wine, most traditionally red wine. You know, you're adding some sugar, you're adding brandy sometimes, and then you're just adding fruit, either berries, citrus, things like that, and you're letting it steep and kind of just infuse over a day, maybe sometimes longer depending on your recipe, and then you're just straining it out and you have this beautiful kind of bright wine punch, if you will. We take things a little bit further than that because we can them and make them a little bit more single serve, but the essence there is still pretty much the same.
And in your effort to make the sangria just a more accessible, ready-made cocktail, because usually it is kind of an event for someone if you're hosting, you know, like, what do you think some of the barriers are to people having sangria as, like, a go-to?
I think the biggest issue is space and just the energy to have to want to do it, really. I mean, yes, we could take wine. I know a lot of people that take wine and we'll throw, like, a flavored vodka in there and then, you know, some sugar and call it a day and say it's sangria. You know, we all know you kind of get out what you put into things. So if you're doing it, you know, kind of the traditional route and you're taking time to cut up wheels of lemons and limes and oranges and you're putting them in wine and you're letting it steep, it's finding a vessel that's big enough, finding fridge space that's big enough, letting it sit overnight, and then tweaking and making it taste good. It's a process. And, you know, unless you've done this a whole bunch, it's not something you usually want to, like, undertake on the fly and just be like, yeah, it'll turn out great. Like, it'll turn out like something, but not always great. So we wanted to have something a little bit more reliable for people and more accessible to be able to take on the go as well.
Yeah, so you started Odyssey Sangria Company. You have a red, a white, and a rosé, and an occasional seasonal sangria as well. You were talking about your history at Metro and developing recipes, being in hospitality, knowing how to curate tastes and menus. So when it came to this recipe, when you're like, okay, what is a quintessential, say, red sangria? How did you develop what is now in these cans? What aspects were most important to you?
Oh, so for me, When it came to the red specifically, I really, really wanted to stay true to kind of the history of Spain and what you see from there. There are many different types of red recipes from Spain, types of red sangria, I should say. I focused on one that I gravitated towards, which, you know, kind of comes from like the northern Spain area, and it actually predates, if I'm correct, I may be wrong on this, but there's one called like Zura. It's like Z-U-R-R-A, or they would call it like Zura Capote, where they would use peaches and nectarines and then finish with like a little bit of baking spice. So like, you know, cinnamon or clove, or add vanilla if they had, you know, enough money back then to do it. And for me, that was just super interesting because we all know mulled wine here. And for people that have ever been to Spain, you know, southern Spain has ski resorts and has winter, just like we do. So I wanted to make something that, you know, was true to that, but also very reminiscent of things that we were used to here in Wisconsin. So our red recipe actually, you know, we kind of dialed it up on the fruit side and then still finished with that baking spice. So we have peach, we have lime, we have raspberry, and then we finish with cinnamon and vanilla. So you take a sip and you get this big, bright fruit flavor up front, and then you swallow, and then right after that mid palate goes away, it just finishes with this long, nice finish of like baking spice and vanilla. So it's pretty cool. And it's awesome to have year round because you get all that fruit, it's a refreshing drink, but that baking spice is really well welcomed, you know, during the cold winter months. So I think people have just kind of not expected that from a sangria, especially from the red. Yeah, and then with the white and the rosé, I wanted something that was a little bit more straightforward and modern and accessible to people. People are used to just, you know, going to a bar or a restaurant and, you know, sometimes they're just taking whatever fruit they have, which is totally understandable. I mean, sangria is a very shared thing, and it also is meant to be useful to minimizing waste, you know, reusing wine or using wine before it's going to go bad. So we wanted to stay true to those kind of easily understood flavors that people would get when they think of sangria. So the rosé has strawberry and kiwi. Yeah, no-brainers, but strawberry is also very big in Spanish cooking, you know? And then with the white, kind of same thing. Bright, like Valencia-style orange up front. Fig in the middle, a little bit of vanilla on the finish. Fig, you know, you can get fig and goat cheese and, you know, on a crostini there, you know? So those were all things where, like, they're familiar to people, but they're also kind of still sticking on those, you know, traditional paths that we wanted to take from.
The motto for this canned sangria odyssey is modern methods steeped in tradition. So you're speaking on that traditional aspect as well. I'd like to touch upon the modern because to me, from the outside, not being in this business,
sure.
The modern aspect is this whole canning process. So how does canning these cocktails, how did this help you develop different recipes or know how to work with the ingredients better and give you a better final product in the end? Because we're used to mixing it, let it steep, then it's probably poured in a pitcher in most places.
Yeah.
But here it is in a can. How does that make it different?
I would say the differences are we can kind of play with some ingredients that maybe previously we would be concerned about going bad or maybe having a different effect over a matter of days or things like that. Now knowing we can take something and put it into a can, and cans have even longer shelf lives than, you know, a capped bottle of beer. So knowing that and being able to say, okay, well, I can make a strawberry, kiwi, rosé, sangria taste literally like it's day one and have a shelf life of 12 to 18 months as long as it's kept in cold storage, which, you know, it is at our distributor. And it's pretty awesome. Just the idea of like being able to use modern techniques and make these cool, fresh, you know, products. I never would have thought 7-8 years ago that this is where we'd be.
So you founded Odyssey along with Tripper Duval, who's also your partner in Lost Whale, and Tom Dufek. So what was your main motivation to make your own impact in the canned cocktail space?
I think the motivation was we've seen a lot of competition from huge companies kind of getting into the game and really throwing money behind it and stuff. And we were like, well, that's all good and well, and they do what they do and they do it well, but we're a bunch of cocktail nerds. Like, between the three of us, we have roughly 40 years of experience combined, you know, and our palates are our money makers. Like, we know how to balance things, we understand ingredients, we understand flavor affinity. So for us, we were like, we just really wanted to kind of put our spin on things and be able to kind of get a foothold and get something out there for our fans and for people that like what we do at our bar, as well as, you know, Tom used to do what we did as well before he got into Plainspoke and owning this facility and owning Youngblood. You know, he comes from a cocktail background as well. So for all three of us, it was just, hey, let's throw our hat in the ring and see if people gravitate towards what we do and appreciate the quality of the product and the care, you know, that we put into our product. And it's been going well so far. So yeah.
Well, speaking of the quality and the care, we're here in a smaller facility in Sun Prairie, but it's small but mighty. And we just had a little look at what the canning process is like. So can you step the audience through a brief overview of like what's the start and how does it end at that canning line?
Oh yeah. So the start is we actually get all of our wine brought in on a freight truck from California in 270-gallon totes that have been sealed off. And the moment it arrives at our facility, it basically gets hooked up to basically a giant hose that feeds it to a filtration system. That filtration system has a like 0.45 micron filter in it, which I barely understand, but it's important because that filtration system actually pulls out any yeast and actually any, it's small enough where it actually pulls out any bacteria as well. So it prevents any bacterial growth or any yeast from secondary fermentation in our product. So we don't have wine that's going into our cans that have any sediment, anything like that. We end up with this really clean, bright product at the end of the day. So the wine gets fed into the tanks first and then all of our ingredients afterwards. Just the wine process and filtration alone can take up to a day. And then all the ingredients being added to steep, and then bringing the entire batch down to temperature and then to carbonate is another day, sometimes two. And then finally, by the last day or possibly 2 days, depending on the size of the purchase order, we're canning and then kegging because we also do recyclable disposable kegs for bars and restaurants as well throughout Wisconsin. So yeah, so it's a pretty, you know, long process to start, you know, from day one to day five or six sometimes. And, you know, we're dealing with the trials and tribulations of everyone else, you know, that kind of coming in on the tail end of this pandemic too. Sometimes we have wine delays. We only really run like a single run, like purchase order a month to use all of that wine right out of the gate. So nothing ever oxidizes, everything goes out fresh. We don't keep product left over here in the production facility, you know, to store. Everything goes direct to distribution immediately and then out to shelves and bars and restaurants, so yeah.
So there's a great amount of, you know, intention and attention to detail with this product.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, and with, you know, we're here in Sun Prairie, and obviously people think of Wisconsin as the brewery state. Like, there's plenty of breweries for beers and such like that. But how important was it to find a local place where you could do this? Was that a top priority to begin with, or did it happen to work out?
It was a top priority mainly because I love Wisconsin. I'm from here. I bought a house here. I have no intention of moving. So like, I didn't want to find a co-packer, you know, while it would be much cheaper to do it, you know, in California, because I don't have to ship wine across the country. I really wanted to do it here. These recipes were developed here. The essence of the brand was created here. So yeah, it was intentional to do it here. Happy accident was finding, you know, a friend who owned a production facility that happened to be my roommate 13 years ago. So that was pretty cool. But yeah, the intention was always to do it here.
What challenges or lessons has Odyssey taught you that you don't think you would have gotten had you focused on staying behind the bar?
I would say the retail side is really big. Like, I know how to make a great product. I don't know anything about marketing. You know, I've had a really great couple of meetings as of late with my distributor. They are a wealth of knowledge, you know, getting to learn just how, you know, a consumer sees things on a shelf, what they gravitate towards, you know, shelf placement, how chain grocery stores work, like all of these things that I have so much to learn still, and I probably will continue learning throughout my career, but it was very eye-opening to say the least.
You mentioned it's still pretty new and off the ground. It's about 15 months old, but how are you feeling? Like, to be here today and you see these cans coming off the production line, going from point A to point C, D, E, F, you know, all down the line. How does it make you feel?
I feel like, you know, I would be remiss if I didn't say overwhelmed, but also like incredibly excited and optimistic. I can't believe the response we've gotten in such a small period of time. I literally just did a sampling at Ray's Wine and Spirits in Wauwatosa and had a gentleman come up to the sampling table and grab a 4-pack of white sangria and say, I literally came here for this because me and my wife were at Draft House in Baraboo, this like new like self-serve draft place that happens to have us on tap. And she fell in love with your sangria and we're in town here today and I saw that you guys are here and I needed to come grab this for her. So thank you, this is one of our new favorite things. And I was like, well, that just gave me fuel for the next year. Like that's why I'm doing what I'm doing. So yeah, it's been wild and I'm really excited. I have a lot of fire and ready to keep, you know, putting out new cool seasonal things and yeah.
Daniel Berez is one of the co-owners of Odyssey Sangria and a partner at Lost Whale Craft Cocktail Bar here in Milwaukee. He joined me at Cullen and Harrison Company Packing in Sun Prairie, Wisconsin last summer. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of today's conversations or you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, simply download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn about celebrated entertainer Liberace's Wisconsin upbringing and the lack of local recognition for this hometown icon. Plus, we'll tell you about WUWM's Vaughn Fellowship. That's tomorrow at noon on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.